and welcome to the Low Tox Life podcast. I'm Alex Stewart, your host, and this is show number 31, and I have an amazing scientist with us today, Pia Weinberg, who I came across at the BBC Futures event. It was a conference, a one-day conference last year where, you know, scientists present on where they believe the future of various things is headed, whether it be space travel, whether it be food. And it was a really, really mind-blowing day. You can imagine when the BBC assembles their best. That's a pretty hectic cast of brains. And I saw Pia speak, and I was really enthralled with the innovative work she was doing around aquaculture, and specifically seaweed, and how you could actually sequester carbon with seaweed and create a more sustainable practice of farming sea vegetables, maintaining ocean health, as well as contributing to overall planetary health with the work that she does, and some really clever food stuff with her incredible food company, which I've popped in the show notes with links to gorgeous pastas and macadamia nuts and things that are basically laced with sea vegetables. So you're not having a huge over concentration to push you into, you know, having too much iodine, because that would also, you know, not be so great for our health. But just to get those essential trace minerals in small amounts into the foods that we're already eating and enjoying in a natural form, not in synthetically boosted things, which so many of our foods are, you know, something from the sea. And the macadamias are absolutely delicious. I've since tried them. So all the details about that are in the show notes. I just want to, before we leap into the chat, remind you that all this month, the wonderful people of Etitude are supporting not only our show, but also giving us a great deal. So with the code SLEEPBETTER, we have 10% off. Now, that's not over their main website link. You have to go to our special website link, and that link is in the show notes as well, and it'll take you straight through. You've even got what my favorite things from the shop are: the Bondi sheet set, which is a really beautiful rich gray. Well, there's a pale mint. And the beautiful thing about what they're doing is they're really looking to shave everywhere possible. Oh God, that sounds like we're shaving hair. We're not. We're shaving water usage. We're shaving resources in production. We're using non-toxic dyes, non-toxic products in our production line. We're paying our farmers just wages. Bamboo is such a sustainable crop. It grows so hard, so fast compared to cotton. And it stands to reason that while there are some incredible organic cotton textile got certified, you know, my shopping bags on the site are organic, got certified shopping bags. In terms of overall choices, I'm a big fan of making use of textiles and things that are using less resources to grow. So kind of like teff in the grain world grows like a gazillion times faster than wheat and is resilient to all sorts of pests, so you don't need to use pesticides. There are those sorts of things that exist in all sorts of areas of daily things that we buy. And while there are some folks, unfortunately, still using a lot of chemicals in bamboo linen production, the guys at Etitude are very, very finicky about what they do and don't use, and have our safety and the planet's health at the absolute centre of their business's ethics code. So I hope you're enjoying the sheets. I know so many people are already, and it's just so lovely that, you know, the reality is, as a show, we need sponsors. It takes hours to put together these shows. The resources of not just myself, but my wonderful assistant Ingrid, and to have the support so that we cover our costs is really just wonderful. So I love that you guys make use of it. Of course, you always have my utmost word that I will only ever bring you the most ethical, always organic options in terms of show partnership and support. Right. So that's that talked about, ticking all the things off my list. It's time to introduce you to Pia. It's a great chat. I urge you to continue to listen, even if you don't think that aquaculture or growing seaweed or farming seaweed is going to be something interesting to you. We really talk about some very interesting things during this chat. I learned so much, and I know you will too. Enjoy. Hello, Pia. How are you?
I'm well, Alex.
That's good. And now I'm so excited to have you on the show because this is something that is a huge global concern and issue at the moment, talking about how we can feed people, how we can get nutrients to the ever-growing global population. And the work that you do is super interesting in that regard. And it's just going to be great. So I would love to just start with just so people can get an idea of what motivates you to do the work that you do. What do you think you love most sharing about the work that you do with people? You meet someone and they say, what are you up to? What do you do? What's your first thing that you just love to share?
Well, I usually explain to people that I didn't wake up as a, 12-year-old being inspired to become a seaweed farmer and make food from it. That wasn't something that was on my radar.
Yeah.
And my driving passion was actually marine conservation and sustainability. And
okay.
Indeed, that's what I've done my PhD in, is the marine systems ecology and sustainability of the oceans. And initially looking at how to make aquaculture sustainable, because, it actually is not the fiend of the seas, as many people think. It's about how you do it. It's just like on land with permaculture and things like that. We grow vegetables, and people understand that if you recycle the nutrients and look after the earth and the soil and the watering systems, then it is actually an ecological system. And aquaculture can be the same thing. But key to that is seaweeds. And that's really how my passion came about, was in doing research in Sri Lanka on tiger prawn farms and realizing that seaweeds were the key to capturing the nutrient waste that was really just a pipeline of sewage going out to the sea from aquaculture. And I mean, humans did that in society centuries ago. We let all our sewage out on the streets and we all got sick. So it's not surprising that the same thing would happen in aquaculture. But if you put seaweeds into the recipe, then you can turn all of that around. But it's very hard for someone to explain to aquaculture industries and government that we should all start growing seaweeds to clean up the environment. So then I started looking at, we should just start growing seaweeds for the nutrients and health benefits, because there are many, many of those. And so then I spent a lot of my research years working with nutritionists and doing the research behind that. And I found that, we can actually kill two birds with one stone if we grow seaweed. We can remediate nutrients and keep the waterways clean and capture carbon dioxide more quickly than in other plants. And the nutritional value is really, really high and is something that's can serve as a missing link in some of the nutritional deficiencies that we've got at the moment.
Mm.
So that's the sort of background and motivation for me now, is that seaweeds really can solve a lot of problems while delivering new, occupational solutions and health solutions.
Beautiful. And there is just so much that you've just said there. I want to ask you a question about probably about six things in there.
Yeah.
So you mentioned as a child that it was more marine conservation. How did you grow up that became a passion of yours?
Well, growing up in Sydney and living by the sea and spending weekends down at, Camp Cove and Watson's Bay and going snorkeling, and just it's amazing to go snorkeling just off the shores in Sydney and see the life that's there. And that just really always stayed with me, inspired me. It was this fantasy world that you could go into as a child. And so marine science just always fascinated me, and I stayed with science through school. And then when I got to university, I really wanted to focus on marine science. So I really just followed my passion. And then you can see, what are the things that need to be done, and what can we do to improve the marine environment, and be true to your interests and passions, and then you'll really follow those and do them well. And that was the inspiration for me, simply putting on a snorkel and mask on the shores of Sydney and looking at what was under the surface.
Amazing. And I've got to say, I went to, we're half Mauritian on my mum's side, and we went to Mauritius this year and my son was sort of old enough to chuck on a snorkel and go swimming alongside me for an hour without getting tired or needing floaties and all that. So it was just a beautiful thing for us to do every day. And it's such a, it's just a gift for a child to be able to see life just doing its thing like that. We're so in life as humans that we don't watch life much, unless we've got parents or a curriculum or a particular teacher that wakes us up to the wonders of life. And I just thought it was such a joyful thing to wake him up to all those fishies under the sea and all the crazy creatures and Yeah, beautiful.
You do,
yeah.
And you become very alert with your senses, the feel on your skin, the sounds, that everything's different. So you become very alert and you absorb and look at details, don't you?
You really, really do. And like when you study marine biology, is there in the current, like in a bachelor's degree, say, is there a huge focus on sustainability and the damage that's being done to our oceans?
There is, to a degree. There's a lot of ecology. I mean, looking at threatened species like they do on land and things like that is something that they do. But there is I studied my undergraduate and my honours research through Stockholm University in Sweden, because I do have a background from Sweden. And in Sweden, they actually do have a very heavy emphasis on ecological sustainability of the oceans at a larger scale. And they have foreign aid research projects throughout developing nations who are actually really trying hard to develop the ocean areas in for their own socioeconomic progress, which is a great thing if it's done properly and a very destructive thing if it's not. So there is a lot of research and applied research effort sending scientists to places like I went to Sri Lanka or Africa and Southeast Asia, where they're starting industries and trying to solve and help them with the issues that are there. And, you know, one of the big things that aquaculture got slammed for, and rightly so, in the last 50 years as it grew, was the rapid destruction of the coastline, the pollution that was going out, the cutting down of mangroves in coastal zones to build, you know, massive prawn farms all the way up the coast. And there's nothing wrong with doing some of those, but you can't rape and pillage your coastline and do that. So that's what we were sent over there to look at, was in actually tiger prawn farms. And they actually shot themselves in the foot, because they built so many farms, they throw all the waste into the lagoon outside the farm. And then they're trying to pump in new seawater, which is actually the lagoon.
So what's the solution to that? I mean, you know, because prawn farming is a huge issue in terms of, also in some parts of Asia where there's antibiotic use that isn't even allowed in some countries. So we're ending up with antibiotics in our oceans. And as someone who's very close to this, what do you think the solution is there?
Well, the solution is learning ecology and learning the ecosystem. It's not that hard. It's simple. It's similar to animals. You know, if you have systems even in land animal production now, you know, your chickens, you need to have a good animal welfare. And animal welfare is not throwing the sewage pipeline back into the pond. And then treat it. So what we need to do is look at the sewage. It's a nutritional resource that can feed the plant side of things. So the tiger prawn farm I was working at was very progressive and very sustainable. So they pumped in saline groundwater from the edge of the lagoon, which was not then contaminated by the lagoon wastewater. They then kept that water and recirculated it. So they grew the tiger prawns for their high-value markets, and then the water went into a settlement pond which had tilapia fish, which eat some of the waste particles, the larger particles, and those fish feed the local people. It's one of their staple fish food sources and has a high omega-3 and nutritional content for the local people. They also grow milkfish, which again is a local fish for eating, and they eat smaller particles in the wastewater. Then they have another pool with mussels, who filter out the smallest particles. And then what you're left with are the dissolved nutrients. And so those nutrients can be absorbed by the seaweeds. So you've got four systems there cleaning up the water naturally and growing new products for the local people to eat. Then the water is oxygenated by the seaweeds. The pH is bumped up again through the consumption of carbon dioxide in the water, and the water can then be returned to the tiger prawns and recirculated that way without any release of nutrient to the local lagoon. So you can see that tiger prawn farming can be very sustainable and provide a lot for humanity, and not have, as long as we design it according to ecological principles.
So just as with permaculture, it's all in the design as to whether it's a good idea or a bad idea in the long term. Yeah, amazing. You know, and I think a lot of people, it proves that nothing's black and white, right? Because, you know, so many people just completely diss prawns, like don't eat prawns, they're bad, you don't know where they come from. But I am such a big believer, just as with meat, if you're an omnivore, We almost have a responsibility to be seeking out the people who are doing it right and sharing information when we do find who's doing it right, so that the good guys grow and and the people who are doing it wrong, well, people aren't going to keep up the business practice that isn't making them any money because everyone stopped buying. So they're going to start doing it like the guys who have got the design right. And and I think with prawns, what I'll do actually for people is just get a few resources for you guys for further reading and pop them in the show notes along with some questions you can ask your fishmonger about where your prawns are from. And just to help us get the word out there on that, because I think we weren't even going to talk about prawns, but it's such
that's where the whole ecosystem's linked, isn't it?
Exactly. It's just such a good example of how we can do it right. Just as with farming, rather than huge feedlot beef, rotating different animals through pasture and making the most of what each of those animals naturally loves to do to regenerate soil as opposed to deplete it. I mean, I get excited when we see, when you have a bit of an education aha moment and people can see there's no do and don't, there's how do we do it right? And and therein lies the actual progress we can make as consumers when we learn who's doing it right and we start supporting them.
That's right. Yeah. And we should ask those questions. Why? Why is it, you know, and rightly so, as you know, conservation agencies dissed aquaculture totally. So aquaculture has a bad reputation, but if we learn to understand that we can do it right, then those agencies, even World Wildlife Fund, are turning around and understanding that we can do it right. And that's where there's aquaculture standards now that are coming into play. And the more that people ask their fishmonger and fish shops about where things come from, slowly that pressure will relay back to the farms and the regulators. And yeah, we will have very sustainable seafood production.
Amazing. And do you have any advice for people while we're on the topic of seafood in the sort of meat sense rather than the veggie sense? Just a few tips from someone who is clearly very close to it all on the most sustainable seafood we can buy?
Well, we can still buy some wild fisheries. Wild fisheries have reached sort of a peak level that we're not going to expand the wild fisheries. And there are some fish that species that we probably shouldn't eat in terms of, you know, the sustainability of them. But the most sustainable one from wild fisheries would be things like pilchards and the anchovies, and also highly, highly nutritious, the sardines and those types of fish.
Yummy.
Because they're full of the omega-3s that we are chronically deficient in the West. They're at the bottom of the food chain. And even though they have peaks and troughs in population linked to mostly, you know, El Nino events and when the nutrient upwellings occur or not, they are the populations that will recover and be maintained very well. Other ones are the octopus, calamari type foods. They're very sustainable, fast reproducing species. And then in aquaculture, you do have to look for there's new labeling, like the Marine Stewardship Council and other seafood marketing. There's Aquaculture Stewardship Council brands now that it can show what is sustainable at the bottom of the food chain in terms of aquaculture fish. And throughout Southeast Asia, you know, the tilapia and the milkfish are very low on the food chain and more sustainable than, say, the ones that are high up on the food chain, like your salmon and things. But that doesn't mean that salmon is actually quite a good sustainable standard for a meat source, if you like, or protein source, because the salmon are actually cold-blooded and is distinct from animals on land that are eating and half in part to keep themselves warm. Salmon don't do that. So you're even on a predator like the salmon, your feed conversion ratios are quite low because they're a cold-blooded animal. And they do have very, very good omega-3 content. So in that way, as long as the salmon industry as well starts to pick up its act
in
looking after the nutrient waste and recycling things. And in Canada, they're starting to do that. They're growing actually seaweeds and mussels around some of the salmon cages.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah.
There's a permaculture garden going on there. And in those cases, you know, even the salmon are something that are very nutritious, full of omega-3s and do have good food conversion efficiencies. But they are eating sardines, and which we could eat instead directly.
Yeah, so true, right?
But they are looking to also to look at replacing a lot of the animal meal in fish feed with vegetable proteins as well, which is, again, where seaweed can come in because it's 40% protein when we're growing. So
exactly. Instead of GMO soy, which if you do your investigating, often ends up being a huge part of salmon pellet feed. So, you know, again, it's about asking those questions. And if you get a shoddy answer, if you don't feel like you can trust it, then do what I do maybe, which is just have salmon once every couple of months as a treat from the beautiful supplier like the Canadian Way, who do have an incredible aquaculture design sustainability program in place. And, you know, I think food miles is something we worry about, but actually it's the way something's produced that produces far more of its carbon effect on the atmosphere than the travel to another country to eat it. It's incredible. But I was learning about this recently on the David Suzuki website, and I'll pop that link there too. There's some incredible research around, you know, buying an organic thing from overseas versus a not so well farmed thing from a local source. Incredible. I would have always thought, oh no, local's definitely best. But yeah, there's some very interesting research out there these days. Anyway, I digress. You're saying yes, you do.
No, but it's all linked, like I said.
It is, yeah.
Very relevant. It's all relevant.
Yeah, supporting the good guys is something that none of us can argue is a bad thing, is a good thing, is a bad thing to do. So now, can you share maybe just on that note of carbon, what has struck you the most in everything that you've studied around climate change and the ocean's current state of health? I mean, as someone who reads a little bit here and there, it's almost like a too hard basket of, oh God, that just all looks so scary if I go down that hole. What concerns you the most as a scientist?
Well, I think that, the oceans are already feeling and showing effects of climate change, of course. And I mean, the big one that we hear on the radio is the Great Barrier Reef, because that is what is a big tourist icon, and we're very close to the Great Barrier Reef, and that's a wonderful thing. But I also think that, you know, people really miss other changes that are not so, well, the Barrier Reef isn't furry and cuddly, but I put it in the category of furry and cuddly things that, you know, make conservation easier to get the message across to people. But there are already some big shifts that are happening on our own coastlines. And some of those, the ocean will adapt. We're already getting, say, Sydney rock oysters, which used to just be on mainland and New South Wales, really. They've actually now turned up in Tasmania. Mm. Sea urchins are turning up in Tasmania that used to only be in New South Wales, and they're eating bare the seaweed areas down there and things like that. So we're getting a shift of animals down the Nemo current, if you liked, and they're changing things. The ocean does have the capacity to adapt, and, you know, things do shift over time. It's just that those shifts are happening very quickly. And so we will have some impacts short term that affect, you know, fisheries production and new species coming in on that local context. But I think that's a change that's sort of now in place and inevitable, and we will adapt to it. There's the other impacts from climate change, the ocean acidification that they talk about as well, where certain animals will struggle, say, to create calcium carbonate shells and things because the ocean acidity is increasing. But then there are others that can actually cope quite well with that, and will also take over. So we will be seeing shifts in species due to temperature changes or acidification changes, both of which are linked to climate change. What's interesting, again, back to seaweeds, is that of anything, seaweeds and algae in the oceans, they were very responsible for taking the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in the beginning for us, when the Earth was a more carbon dioxide rich atmosphere and oxygen was produced and then filled up the atmosphere. It was the algae and the seaweeds that were very largely responsible for that.
Oh, wow.
And we can actually take up carbon dioxide in our seaweed production much faster than many land crops, because the carbon dioxide's encapsulated in the seawater. It's not, you know, floating in the air, and the seaweed tumbling through it, you can actually take it up very quickly. So for every ton of seaweed, wet seaweed we'd grow, or dry seaweed we would grow, dry weight equivalent, we would be capturing a ton of carbon dioxide. And they're using seaweed in China already in aquaculture areas, for example, in bays, and showing that if they grow fish, the fish drop nutrients and they grow shellfish around those fish, then that aquaculture also produces a lot of carbon dioxide because they're breathing out. They're animals that are eating and respiring and they're breathing out carbon dioxide. But if they then grow seaweed around those as well, not only is the seaweed taking up the nutrients, it's taking up the carbon dioxide from the animals, but also additional carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. And it's actually offsetting the acidification and buffering it, making it much more alkaline. So in bays, you can actually offset ocean acidification just by growing seaweed.
Amazing. And is this something governments are paying attention to and funding?
There's research happening and to show how this is the case in those sorts of systems, but there's nothing at the moment that's looking at, you know, implementing seaweeds in a big way. The CSIRO has done some work looking at offsetting ocean acidification in the southern end of the Barrier Reef and done some modelling. And, you know, to offset the impact on the Barrier Reef, which is huge, of course, you're going to have very huge seaweed farms if you're just going to look at that simple mammoth calculation. But I think that we should always focus, you know, think globally in terms of these global big problems. But the solutions are not often the big gigantic one solution fits all. It's actually bring that global thinking to your local context and create industries that slowly can grow and multiply and that are industries that capture carbon. And I don't think, you know, like you wouldn't want one massive coal industry and we're moving more to localized energy production, that in a similar way you'd move to more nodes of localized seaweed or sustainability operations that can offset climate change, and slowly those things will start to grow and collectively in the future will have a big impact and importance in terms of shifting the balance in the carbon economy. So I think that we do need to think big and globally, but start intervening at the local scale instead of waiting to intervene for the one big solution that's going to solve it all, because rarely that's usually a very risky way to go. And we do have the small scale solutions here now. So it would be great if government could support those smaller scale solutions, because they're usually looking for the big monolithic solutions that will fix everything.
And that's never the case. It's never going to be the case. So, yeah, it's kind of like I'm a big believer in grassroots in terms of the power of the consumer and what we fill our shopping baskets with as a way to preserve the health of people and planet. And, you know, if we waited for the government to finally do something, or for any head of state anywhere, or for an association who recommends certain dietary modalities to change there, then we would be waiting a very long time, because all those people are just so stuck in a system that almost perpetuates same-same that
yes.
It is actually up to us, small business, small industry, to be the innovative, nimble people that we are. We can literally, as a consumer, from the very basic N equals one, you can say, I'm not going to buy that anymore, I'm going to buy this.
Yes.
And, you know, as a business owner, you can say, I'm not going to make stupid plastic promotional tools anymore, I'm going to make this to share with my customers. As an aquaculture scientist, you can say, I'm not going to rape and pillage the oceans, I'm going to do this. And
exactly.
Everyone can do something at any level that we're at. Mm-hmm. There's a huge sense of disempowerment in our world at the moment, and I just like to remind everybody that we have huge amounts of power, no matter what we're doing, especially power over our own bodies and what we put in our mouths.
Absolutely. The customer is the key, and I think that people forget that and think that it's, you know, big corporations and government controlling everything, but actually it isn't.
If
the people on the ground make the decisions, then the leadership will follow.
Absolutely. No one likes to be unpopular.
No.
So I'm so proud of myself for not mentioning Trump then. That was really, I was very restrained. Okay, moving on, still not going to mention him. Obviously, as a scientist, you started to see the magic of seaweed, its potential in sequestering carbon, but also as a food, as you mentioned before, to help people deal with deficiencies. What was your next step? Like we say, you know, let's take the power as a business owner, as a scientist at whatever level you're at. How did you actually get started? And what is it that your business, you sort of have two sides to your business, don't you? Very much a research and a food production arm. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, of course. We'll continue to have our research and development activities for decades to come as we look to different species of seaweeds to grow and different applications of those seaweeds. And there's so many exciting and unique molecules in the seaweeds. You know, there's the basic nutritional ones, but there's even other exciting molecules that you just don't get in land plants, and we're continually exploring those. You know, for me, and coming out from academia and then realizing that, you know, I'm tired of writing papers about this and saying this is what should happen. It's I really stepped out of university a couple of years ago and said, all right, I've got to make it happen. And that was a challenging thing, because then, you know, you're giving up a career focus, I guess, in a way, and you're not able to publish as much as you would have to in an academic sense. So you're sort of releasing yourself from that career in a way, but joining a new one and talking to investors and business people and trying to make it happen. And that was really exciting, but it also makes you face the decisions about, okay, we have to get to market with this seaweed, and what are the important nutritional things that we can start addressing? And, you know, the seaweed has 40% protein, which is great, but what are the deficiencies and the really important things in it? And that, in part, is trace elements, of course. We need to eat vitamins and trace elements sometimes, or trace elements mostly if the land and soil are deficient in that and we're not able to get it through the plants. But the ocean always has those trace elements present. So the seaweed.
Oh, that's fascinating. Yeah. Especially for us in Australia, where we've got super low zinc soil.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
The ocean receives all the nutrients back from the land eroding to sea, and it will never run out of trace elements, basically. So growing seaweeds in seawater will deliver you those trace elements, which is a great thing. But then the other exciting one was the dietary fibres. And you know, many people are aware we might be deficient in trace elements, and they're aware we're deficient in omega-3 and that we need to find those sources. Only really becoming aware, although we've heard of dietary fiber before, but we still are chronically deficient in dietary fiber. They estimate that we need about 30 to 40 grams a day, depending on who you are and the size you are, but we're really only getting half of that. And that's about feeding the gut flora. Again, it's an ecosystem here, but it's about feeding the gut flora, and the gut flora in turn are processing and feeding you. Indeed, you've got more bacterial microbial cells than you do human cells. And if you're not feeding those and maintaining the right ecosystem of gut flora, you're not maintaining your own personal health. And that area of research is becoming huge and really exciting field of research. But if you put seaweed into the mix, it actually can provide a quick and efficient solution. It's very hard to change the whole modern food production system, but it's easier to inject things and improve more rapidly by adding something that addresses that deficiency. And that is seaweed and the dietary fibers. And we've had some really exciting results in that area. And that's really, for me, when I realised that, okay, we can get to market here very quickly and make a sustainable industry via financial viability in the long term.
Mm. And something I noticed at the BBC Futures event at the end of last year, where I saw you speak with the lovely Dr. Mosley, was at the lunch, there were some of the products that your company makes in the spread. Unfortunately, I couldn't eat them because I'm very allergic to gluten. But what I loved about the concept was that it wasn't 100% seaweed pasta. It was, you know, I think you could tell me what the percentage is actually. How much do you add in?
It's only about 10% seaweed. That's the exciting thing with seaweed, is that you don't need to have a whole plateful of it, which is what many people think. Oh, seaweed's great. Now I need to eat a whole bowl of seaweed.
So human, isn't it? Like, oh, yay, let's just have everything. Oh, why don't I feel better? Actually, you've now overdosed in iodine. That's why you don't feel better.
Exactly. It's human nature, I think. But that's in a way why we figured, you know, people are into the sushi. They're getting that. But that's such a rare event type of food that people are eating. But we actually need to eat just a little bit of seaweed every day. Mm. And so how are we going to do that? And one of the main things that people eat is pasta. And, you know, you can make gluten-free pasta as well. We've done that for people who have the gluten issues. But we also know that with the, you know, the good quality durum semolina that we use in this fettuccine pasta is a very good one. And so 10% seaweed into that adds trace elements. Mm. And in addition, it adds the dietary fiber equivalent dose of what we've shown in a study to improve gut flora, even reduce inflammation in the system and cholesterol and insulin requirements as well. Mm. So in people that were deficient and overweight. So, you know, just a little bit of these dietary fibers can make a big difference every day. And having pasta is one easy way to do that. We also do muesli bars, and that was our mission here, is to make it easier for people to access and eat the seaweed without having every day to think about it and change their ways and necessarily learn how to cook with it, which is a great thing if you want to do that. That's wonderful. But we do have to think about improving things for mainstream here, and mainstream isn't out there exploring new culinary cooking experiences every day.
So. No, you're absolutely right. And tell me, are you able to keep the costs to what a normal packet of pasta would be in a supermarket, given seaweed is so inexpensive? Or is it the actual, I mean, you know, I'd imagine it
able
actually
to be competitive with good quality pasta brands for sure. Mm. It's very hard to compete, you know, with the cheaper mass produced.
Yeah, of course.
Cheap products out there that may be quite nutritionally deficient. And I think as with any new industry, as these industries come into play and grow, they, you know, it's like solar panels.
Yeah, there'll be an economy of scale. Absolutely. Yeah.
And then now, you know, a lot of people have them. We're not as expensive as solar panels were in the beginning, but we are in the upper end of price in terms of pasta. But as we scale and as the industry scales, that will become a mainstream, and it's just like any other crop, you know, it's farmed sustainably. You do lose some of the economies of scale if you go from a very large scale mass produced, you know, industry, but and increase the costs there a little bit, but pretty competitive with other good quality sources of food.
Mm, I love it. And the other thing I loved about it was the fact that someone isn't going to find that it tastes funny. So I got sent something, you know, it was a bit of a paleo trend kind of product, I guess, that was a pastaless pasta of pure seaweed. And, you know, I thought, I'm happy to give it a go. And I cooked up a really gorgeous ragu and, you know, served it. And we all just took a bite and went, that just tastes like I'm eating sea ragu. it does not taste right. It doesn't taste Western. And, you know, I mean, I love my Asian foods. I'm actually mad for seaweed in context of a gorgeous seaweed salad at a Japanese restaurant, you know, that kind of thing. But it just tasted so far from normal that it didn't make the meal taste right. And what I love about what you're doing is the recognition that it doesn't take a lot, and you can incorporate it into things that people already love to get those trace elements and the fiber up. You've got macadamias as well. I saw those on the website. I thought, I've got to get those.
Yeah,
they look delicious.
We roasted our macadamias in the seaweed with a touch of wasabi, not too much, but just enough. And no, they're very tasty.
Gorgeous. Now, something you talk about, the Venus Shell Systems, rapidly growing unique seaweed biomass for various industries, so cosmetics, supplements. How do you grow it rapidly? Like, is there a you know, just in terms of people starting to understand that, like, I guess what I'm trying to say is when we hear rapidly growing wheat, we think, oh my gosh, it's been hybridized to within an inch of its life. It's not going to be digestible anymore. You know, there's a lot of knowledge around crops that have been tampered with to accelerate their growth and their growth and not being necessarily good for us anymore. That doesn't seem to be the case with seaweed though, right? Could you explain how you're able to do that?
Mm. So one of the ways we actually grow our seaweed in swimming pools, if you like, just to isolate them and to capture carbon dioxide when we're growing it. So we capture carbon dioxide from ethanol fermentation. So any natural, you know, if you had a cow manure pile and it starts fermenting on the ground, it will create methane, and you can burn that methane and turn it into a natural carbon dioxide. Or if you're a beer brewery and you're brewing yeast, your yeast are producing carbon dioxide. There's a lot of natural sources of carbon dioxide that are in the biosphere. Mm-hmm. Not talking fossil fuel carbon dioxide here, because if you can capture that too, but it's also got a lot of other metal contaminants and things. But the carbon dioxide that naturally comes from our biosphere and industrial processes, and you know, beer brewing, for example, quite a lot of beer brewing around. So we could actually put a seaweed farm next to a beer brewery.
I was just about to say, are we going to start to see breweries popping up on coastlines to work in conjunction with aquaculture? That'd be hilarious. Yep. But totally makes sense. Imagine if industries talk to each other. This is our waste. Can you do anything with that waste in your industry? Oh, yes, great, awesome. Let's work next to each other. It'd be amazing. Right. It's kind of you know, the modern medicine idea that we have these specialists that we go and see for literally one organ in the body, and they don't talk to any other organ specialists sometimes about, like, what the other, you know, my holistic dentist always says, yes, you've got teeth, but those teeth are attached to a body, and that's what I'm concerned about. You know, different specialists talking to different specialists is just like different industry talking to different industry. And it seems like, once again, it comes down to connectedness and curiosity and learning from each other and seeing how we can all benefit each other.
Oh, yeah. No, one of my colleagues, he calls that the colliding cauldrons of knowledge.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. How good is that? Colliding cauldrons of knowledge. I'm so writing that down. That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, it's where really exciting things happen. And you know that so many people know a lot about certain areas that would just make sense to you if you just sit down and have that cup of coffee and talk about it, and the industries that can benefit, and research and industry as well starting to communicate better. And so that's what we've done. So we're capturing carbon dioxide that's from a fermentation process. And because the rapid growing seaweed, it's growing rapidly because everything the seaweed wants on the plate is there all the time. You know, if you grow a crop and there's not enough, you know, nutrient in the soil or water, or it's too much sun or not enough sun, that you don't get the optimum growth rates. But if you add those things, you get much faster growth rates. So, and we're, in addition to that, being able to concentrate the carbon dioxide into the seawater as we're pumping that in. So that's how we're getting the rapid growth rates, is just through optimizing everything to the maximum for the seaweed. It's loving it so much, it's growing fast. So that's the speed of the growth. And because they're not growing roots and shoots and other things like that, because they're not like plants, they're algae. They're lots of cells stuck together, but they're just getting all their energies putting into the actual leaves, if you like. The leaves are doing everything. They're not real leaves, but it would be as if your banana tree was just growing bananas, and that's all it could put its energy into. So we could grow on a hectare of land equivalent, we could grow about 100 tons of dried weight seaweed in a year.
Wow.
If you look at wheat, that would be about 5 tons.
Isn't that incredible?
That's so very fast.
Very fast and so sustainable.
So no genetically modified seaweeds growing rapidly.
This, yay, hooray.
Rapidly, absolutely.
Oh, good. Now, what's the most exciting thing you're working on with your team right now? Is there something you guys have got bubbling away that you just can't wait to share with people, and you may give us an exclusive?
We actually have a number of sort of, I'd call them our blue sky projects as well, because, you know, the pasta is, for me, a real game changer and, you know, going to change things at the bottom of the food chain for people. But also in the long term, I'd love to scale and do more of the aquaculture feed industry. But, you know, we have to be a lot bigger industry before we can tackle that. We're sort of the salt and pepper on their aqua feed at the moment. It's not enough of it being produced as yet. But
you let me know when you start supplying salmon farmers, and you can vouch that they're doing the right thing by people and planet and fish, of course. Yeah. You let me know, because I would love to let people know.
We'll do that. We're doing a little bit with the abalone industry, and we've actually put omega-3 back into abalone being fed our seaweed now, because if they're fed land crops, they don't get the same omega-3 as they would from the ocean food sources. So that's exciting, and we do maintain that smaller abalone industry link as one of our, you know, core aquaculture projects for the future. But some of our blue sky, I would call them, projects are related to the molecules that are very unique in the seaweeds. And these are, you can imagine that seaweeds grow in salty water in the ocean, mm-hmm. and our human bodies are salty as well. So the connective tissue in the seaweed is connective tissue that has to survive and work in an osmotically challenging environment, saltiness, and the same in our bodies. So the connective tissues in seaweed and humans are quite similar.
Oh.
And so we're finding these very unique molecules now that could be used to replace some of the, biofabrication or artificial tissue engineering and things like that. Wound healing, for example, printing new.
Oh my God.
People so that skin cells can repair faster by putting in the connective tissue ahead of the human being able to develop the connective tissue themselves. And that's really exciting because the molecules from the seaweed are much more similar to human molecules than you'd even imagine. And at the moment, some of the sources that we have to get those types of molecules from, they can either be shut from sharks like shark cartilage, which is not necessarily sustainable, or from pig mucosa and cooking pig intestines to get those molecules. Then you have, then you have issues with religions that don't eat pigs being able to access that technology. And so this is really a marine sea vegetarian solution to some of these connective tissue and regenerative medicine solutions. So I call them that our blue sky projects, but they're very real. And we're already able to show that we can have accelerated wound healing by applying our seaweed molecules to human cells.
Incredible. Oh, Pia, you guys are just amazing. What you're working on, that is, it's such a wide breadth of solutions that can be had from the humble sea veggie.
Yeah.
Now, can I just ask, so I was with my son at the beach the other day down at Redleaf, and we found a huge, great big piece of seaweed. He loves collecting things like that and bring them home. And we sort of asked ourselves, well, I wonder if we could chuck that in the dehydrator, turn it into a powder and sprinkle it on foods to add those trace elements that we've been talking about.
Yeah.
How do we, because we then tried to find out whether we could eat that seaweed, whether it was safe. Mm-hmm. How does one find out, as a keen forager, whether you can just pick some up and take it home and chow down?
But generally speaking, seaweeds are quite safe. If you say you don't go picking mushrooms, we know that without knowing exactly what they are, because they can be highly toxic. It's rare to have any seaweeds that have really high toxicity. There are some red seaweeds that might be very high in bromine compounds and things that are a little bit less desirable to eat. So I'd avoid mostly eating, bright red seaweeds that if you're not familiar with them. There's some very good red seaweeds as well, but some that you're not familiar with, maybe not so. One red seaweed that is very common along our shorelines in the summer months is nori. It looks a bit like a browny, purpley sea lettuce, and it's actually a red seaweed, even though it's browny, purpley colour. So we have our own Australian nori. So if you see a stretchy sea lettuce-y looking thing, you can actually take that home and dry it and use that. But as I said, generally they're very safe. The one thing you have to think about is the environment they're growing in, because as I said, seaweeds take up all these trace elements. But if you're growing in an environment with arsenic or lead or industrial some places around it, then seaweed will pick that up and you will have those heavy metals in your seaweeds as well. So you need to be in a coastline and a catchment that's very clean.
Yes. So if the water's murky, stay away.
If the water's murky and if you're in an industrial area, I wouldn't go eating seaweed in Sydney Harbour, even though it's a lovely harbour. We do have industries around there and things like that. So, where we are on the south coast of New South Wales, we've got massive national parks in our catchments, and so this coastal waters are very good. Yeah, so clean water is important. But the brown seaweeds can be very high in iodine. So we do need iodine. We are very deficient in it. But as you'd be aware, we only need trace amounts of it. Mm. So some people have overdosed on brown seaweeds heavy in iodine, and this has affected them and their thyroid. So just dose mildly with the brown seaweeds. Yeah. But you can actually collect very fresh, healthy-looking ones from the beach and dry them and powder them and put them onto things. That's generally fine. Mm. You are allowed in different states. There's different rules about it as well. You're allowed to pick up 20 kilos of seaweed for personal use in New South Wales off the beaches.
Oh, wow.
Most people do that for compost, but you're not really allowed to go and harvest and pick lots of the wild seaweeds.
Well, that would make sense, yeah. Thank you so much for this chat. I have learnt so much. I know everyone out there will have learnt so much. I'm obviously going to link to the FICO Food Co range website.
Right.
Because, you know, for anyone out there who wants to give the pasta a taste, try some macadamias. I think it's absolutely worth it. I'm certainly going to be, I was writing out my questions thinking, oh, I've got to order those macadamias. And then, you know, 2 weeks went past and we're finally talking. I am motivated. I'm going to do that today.
and another gluten-free option is the fuka. It's our gold medal winning dukka, which we call fuka. It's a 10% seaweed, and you wouldn't know there's seaweed in it. It's cumin and sesame seeds and
things like that.
You can just grill your vegetables or toss it through your rice salads or couscous salads or whatever, and it's an easy one to add seaweed into your food with as well.
Beautiful. Well, I know everybody out there will love supporting you and the work you do by chowing down on something from the range. It's just, as we were saying in the interview, if we can start supporting more people who give full traceability and can effectively demonstrate that they're doing good for people, planet and sea, then, you know, as if we wouldn't want to support that. So I wish you every bit of luck in your incredible endeavours, Pia, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for providing the forum for people to learn more and be educated about things, which is equally important.
You're so welcome. Thank you so much for joining me for today's show. Check out the show notes at lowtoxlife.com/podcast. And if you wanted to maybe share a quote and something that really jumped out for you, you can find us on Instagram at lowtoxlife or simply hashtag lowtoxlife across social media. I absolutely love bringing you the show. Thank you for any of the star ratings or one-line reviews that you guys have left. It helps me know what you've been loving and what you'd love to see more of. I'll see you next week.
For your ears.
Who is that?
Hi, Puck Pass.